Okay, well, Bevan, I think this is recording now, yes. The idea, I think, is Norma has asked if we wanted to make a contribution to a book that she's writing after the book that she has shown us on New Racism. It's a sort of a companion book addressing New Racism as well, but looking at vignettes or examples to illustrate some of the points that she was making in the other book, which I've read cover to cover, which dealt with some of the way people have done research. And from what I can gather, what she was arguing, which follows on from a lot of her other work in the past, is that sometimes people do research that actually creates problems and has nuances of racism that they may not be aware of, and in actual fact are in fact just doing racism but in more subtle ways. So I gather that was the gist of the first book, and I think she was asking us to be completely open in reflecting on perhaps Australian issues and Australian racism, and seeing what we can contribute from our experiences. And I think she was particularly interested in your experience and whether or not you want to write something on your own, or whether we do something together as well, is open. And in fact, even doing the podcast in itself is a form of publication, because if we develop a Socratic dialogue, it can be a basis for a publication, and it can certainly be linked if we're both happy with a wiki that deals with democratic processes to enhance democracy. And just perhaps to open the discussion. Last night I was watching the program on the ABC of the children, the migrants who were brought from Britain, the child migrants, and incarcerated in a farm outside New South Wales as a result of a Rhodes Scholar's suggestion. It's actually a South African Rhodes Scholar who suggested that a way to solve the problems of poverty in Britain was to send the children to the colonies. And he said, well, you'll help populate the colonies and you'll help remove the poor from Britain. And children of five, sometimes not even five, were sent. And of course, this has been a week when Rudd has apologised for the treatment of children, and I thought, recently we've had an apology to the stolen generation and an apology in general for colonial past. And it seems that if we think of the work of Martha Nussbaum, which you may or may not know about, but anyway, her argument you would know, she says, nation states have become perhaps a little more aware of injustice towards some of their citizens, but children are still not being, their rights are not being addressed. Sentient creatures are certainly not being addressed, and certainly people who don't have citizenship rights, like refugees and asylum seekers, are not being considered. And of course, we've got all those problems at the moment as well, with protecting our borders and facing climate change, and knowing that there'll be plenty more people coming to compete for a place that's livable as their areas are made increasingly unlivable from civil war and climate change. So there are lots of areas that aren't being addressed by by citizenship rights and a need to be looked at in terms of human rights. And I know that Aboriginal Australians often had to invoke human rights legislation to try and get citizenship rights to catch up. And I, having said all that as a broad introduction, I wonder if you want to talk about the relationships between the powerful and less powerful within the nation state, and perhaps reflect on marginalised groups, women, children, Aboriginal Australians who until 1967 didn't have full recognition, and what do you think of progress to date, and what you would like to contribute to that in terms of commenting on
racism. This is a formal discussion.
Yes.
And I was just exploring some of the thoughts that when you talk about social justice and talk about things like inequity, and you talk about hegemonic societies or the dominant cultures, and I think we've had a discussion before around, I think Norma Rom mentioned the binary opposites.
Yeah.
And that those binary opposites, it was that the binary opposites actually fascinated me, because we were teaching racialization theory in the School of Education with all 40 students as part of the Indigenous education topic, and in there they had one section of the racialization theory about scientific thinkers and social Darwinism. But it was before that, Dr. Douglas Morgan, who did a PhD around philosophy, mentioned the Pythagoreans and talked about the binary opposites there. And I thought, well, here's perhaps for me, was going back to see where was there an actual starting point. Because in some way or another, if you look at human development and the trends that go with it, especially if you look at traditional societies and then you look at how they sort of developed into more advanced societies to some extent, especially certain groups, and how that interaction with each other, those particular groups, how that interaction with each other actually furthered that development in terms of it could have been scientific development, it could have been technology, could have been social skills, governance, anything. Could have been the whole gamut. But when I looked at that, somewhere along the line, they've actually implanted the binary opposites, which to me seem to be attached to, and our language structure is, I think, actually promotes racism, whether you call it new racism or whether it's subtle racism. But how language structures are so, there's so many words in there that actually link, for example, social justice is a word that actually strongly links to racism.
I think you're absolutely spot on. You have hit upon, I think, the really deep issue of polarization of us, them categories that are mutually exclusive when in actual fact they're not. We have constructed this either-or thinking instead of understanding that reality is not like that. Many new physicists are actually rediscovering the indigenous wisdom that, in fact, we should think in terms of inclusionality, not in terms of us-them. We are actually part of the environment. We are air, water, soil. We sure as anything going to return to that. We are really part of a wider whole. And people like Alan Raynor that I've met recently, he's a biologist based in Bath,
who's very interested in new maths, new physics, and I said to him, well, this isn't new, this is very old. This is actually indigenous wisdom that is being rediscovered. And if you, I may be completely wrong, and this is why it's lovely having this conversation. For instance, the spiritual symbols of the circle, the mandala, even the symbol of the boomerang, of, you know, what you throw out, you get back, that sort of eternal return. That kind of idea is something that is being rediscovered in maths through the Möbius band, which actually suggests that sets are not just one, two. They are, in fact, a folded back Möbius strip that has sections that are inside and outside. And if you take two pieces of string, and I've done this exercise with a very interesting man called Kaufman, who's a physicist come mathematician, and you rotate these two strings, and it's possible for them to be one or two or linked, depending on how you rotate them. And he said, what does this mean to you? And I said, well, it actually is a way of demonstrating in maths that, in fact, our idea of saying things are separate, one or two, is incorrect. And if you think about the idea that every single, Alan Rehn has even developed a new form of maths where he says we shouldn't just think of one, two, three, we should think of one, all the intermediate numbers that are linked to two, and so on, so that really consciousness is a continuum, and the artificial discrete categories that we impose is almost, and they blame it on Aristotle, but in actual fact, if one looks at Aristotle's work, not even Aristotle intended that we think entirely in terms of categories, because he was very keen on the notion of dialogue, the dialectic, conversation, and building ideas together, and he was the one who came up with the idea that matching right kinds of knowledge in context, he called it phronesis, is what you do through engaging with other people. And he was very profoundly affected by the idea of democracy, even though they excluded slaves and women, but still the notion of dialogue was important, and seeing the connections across different options. But he did try to make sense of the world by means of categories, and of course those categories have to be seen as approximate and fluid, and of course people haven't seen it that way.
They've had to make some sense somehow of reality around them, and then I mean that would probably be one concept about how people like Aristotle would have thought in terms of looking at what's there, how do you test what's there is real, these sorts of things. And it would have been a journey of discovery, but for me, going back then and looking at their ability to think in those terms, even back then, was pretty complex. Even for them, at that particular time, would have been a pretty complex thing to do, to give the world around you some sort of meaning.
And you have to take decisions or make cuts, as Wes Churchman would say, that Latin for cuts. But as long as one realises that you're drawing a line, that you're saying, look, we have to make sense of things and say this is the best possible.
But Churchill, people like Churchill, did those sorts of things in hindsight. If we go back before then,
Churchman,
would have, to some degree, might have done things in hindsight too. But I was interested in looking at, you know, when you talk about new things like new races and those sorts of things, it is an extension of racism, but in more subtle form.
And
how they do it now in terms of, like, it's become an industry. Basically, racism, is it a good thing? Is racism a good thing? I mean, one could argue the point that racism is a good thing from the point of view that without racism there wouldn't be that industry, the industry of social justice, the industry of the other, the industry of ethnicity. But that's only one idea of it to see it.
Yeah.
And people are actually using this as an industry. I mean, it's woven in, and it doesn't just apply to Indigenous Australians. I mean,
no.
They're basically, to some extent, by contesting the other, by marginalising themselves in terms of actually organisations, community organisations, the Aboriginal legal rights set up specifically for Aboriginal people, Yungurendi from the university, specifically all Indigenous staff, basically, for Indigenous students.
So if you didn't recognise that racism exists, then there would be no way to justify contesting it. I get your point.
So it's become, I mean, this is, if there's a new form of racism, there is another one for you. But the point, and I've often thought about this, because we tend to construct to support the industry, we make sure that we have to keep the language alive, the other, the use of the word other, ethnicity, social justice, equal opportunity, all of those sorts of things that we need to have. That's our armoury for actually supporting and making sure that we keep this industry alive. We have to use the words like marginalisation. We have to marginalise ourselves if we're wanting to basically get this point across. Therefore, we become the other. We maintain the other.
There's a double-edged sword. There's a feedback loop there. And yes, I think that is probably spot on. And it is a very systemic observation that you have made, and it sort of proves the point that systemic approaches are essential.
And racism itself is a motivator for people to perpetuate racism in terms to make sure that things like, I notice those people that are heavily involved in that, in fighting against the so-called injustices and trying to fight for social justice, all those sorts of things. Those people are actually getting a good living out of it. I mean, it's motivated them to get a better education. It's motivated them to have a better lifestyle, to be able to develop other skills, language skills and otherwise.
Yes.
Articulation skills that can assist in either promoting, to some extent we're still promoting, but at the same time we're fighting against it. So I'm just wondering to what extent we've now embedded, like, I think racism, all the language structures that we've got around that built around that particular concept is so huge, has become so big that it's now in every pore of the body. It's not just in the sight. It's now gone further. And it's like a cancer, you just can't get rid of it, because we promote environmental factors that promote cancer.
We do.
Now, we ourselves, we know that we're doing this, but we keep doing it. But here we are trying to fight against it.
Which brings me to a practical example. Spradley, I think the guy's name is, and I brought this document around so that I could remember the guy's name. He has been trying to have a go at the carbon emissions trading scheme that Rudd is supporting, and the reason he's having a go at it is because he says that carbon emissions trading schemes are, in fact, going to be self-perpetuating, because you are, in a way, and incidentally, the report isn't available, it's been embargoed, but the argument is exactly the same argument that you are making, if you give me a moment, because what he's saying is that you are, in fact, commodifying carbons, and you're trying to use a market-based approach to address a problem that has been caused by the market. So you really are getting the foxes to look after the hen house. And so what we need to do really is to reconstruct the whole way in which we see ourselves in relation to others and the environment. And we need to see ourselves as, I think, the most profound thing I've gained is this notion, the Aboriginal notion of, you know, we are the land. Quite frankly, we are. And without it, we can't breathe, we can't eat, we can't live, and we return to the land. I mean, essentially, we are water, earth, and air. And once people get that sense that we are actually not able to commodify or separate ourselves from environmental issues, then perhaps we will wise up to this notion of trying to put a price on everything.
So if you take that those comments that you just spoke about, and this thinking's coming in pretty raw and fresh here.
Yeah.
But it's along similar lines in terms of that we're looking at the global context. Global societies in particular, before it used to be multicultural societies. Global societies, I mean, what it basically insinuates is that there's always going to be the other. And because racism is systemic in terms of everything, and that it's even in governments, it's even in the economy, social structures, within the psyche. And one of the things about racism within the site is that when you have the other coming to Australia for a better life, they're going to want to some degree remain as the other in terms of adding to the economy, not only the economy here, but to their own economy itself within the family.
Yes.
Or within the individual. Because they're going to want to, and I notice that this happens in lots of global societies, where you've got, if you're a Vietnamese background, then you're always cooking your Vietnamese meals, and then you've got Vietnamese restaurants, and so you're promoting the other, and the other promotes, still out of that connotation, still linked with things like racism. So given that, I mean, it's a pretty, even... it's a pretty difficult task when you've got that occurring globally, really, especially in developing countries like, say, America, Britain. I think it's within 10 years Britain's going to be the minority, whites in Britain are going to be in the minority. I think within 30 years in Australia, I think whites will be in the minority.
And
within
America,
Australia.
I think it's
in America,
it's already just about there.
So then how do we then is there going to be a reconstruction of the new racism or racism itself?
Well, perhaps
the actual phenomenon.
Perhaps it could be seen as diversity being a very positive thing, cultural diversity, inspiring people to think in different ways and to contribute to society, because surely if you've got many different ideas, it can be quite healthy, just as having many different plants can be a very good idea rather than having mono culture, which is very problematic, because if something goes wrong with one plant, if it doesn't adapt well to the environment, then you're in trouble. And the same, I believe, applies to cultures, that it's very good to have many different cultures and different ways of responding, because they're different options, provided, of course, those diversities don't jeopardize the well-being of others and the environment. And I think that's the sort of test that West Churchman comes up with, where he says complexity and diversity is very good to the extent that the diversity and freedoms of living creatures, human beings and living creatures, don't in fact undermine the sustainability and livability of the whole, and I guess that's where we've got to draw the line, and that's, I suppose, what democracy was supposed to be able to do. Of course, democracy has been having a very bad run lately because it's been too closely linked with the market.
Yeah. But the other point that you just brought up for me in what you've just said was that identity and how that promotes, to some degree, marginalisation, because you then start getting enclaves.
Yes.
Even in multicultural societies, to some extent, unless, like for example, the Elizabeth experience, the Norwood experience, and the Thatcherian experience, where you had Elizabeth were mainly British migrants.
Yes.
And they were basically actually marginalised by being put out there. They didn't marginalise themselves to some extent, but they did. They were also marginalised in that they were all British migrants, so they would stick them in Elizabeth. For the Italian society, were mainly put out within the Norwood region sort of thing, and the Greeks were mainly congregated around Thebeton. And you've still got these enclaves being built within, even though we say that they're contemporary societies and that they're globalised societies, but really they're not, because they're still marginalising, and to some extent I think people are still wanting to retain their own identity. But I can ask the question that maybe is identity actually promoting racism?
That's a very good point, actually. A very good point.
Because I notice that here, even within the university, in terms of... And all these words come back. They're all sticking together. This is a band of words here that are following this phenomenon of racism all around through our life. And along behind it comes all the words like identity, separate, other, you name it, anything that looks at dealing with any aspect of the phenomena of racism, there's a terminology that's centred around that, and that surely, when you get that sort of thing, even identity surely must be a part of that.
It is
adding to and promoting that phenomena of racism.
And it's because I think we have used identity to define ourselves, certainly in Western enlightened thinking, in terms of being separate, whereas I think in many cultures identity isn't defined in terms of separateness. It's identity is in terms of your membership of a group or your ability to care for land. And there's a great movement now, I think, from people like Ulrich Beck, thinkers like Martha Nussbaum and Peter Singer, and those who are into the sort of new physics and trying to rediscover indigenous wisdom, the idea that we've got to identify with earth politics and identify with the planet and identify with something bigger than ourselves. And once we can do that, then I think we start to reconstruct how we see ourselves and our relationship to others.
I was in a football club, Australian Rules Football Club, one day, and I was standing there having a squash, because I don't really take for alcohol. But I remember this one discussion that this non-Indigenous white Australian was talking to me about Aboriginal people, and specifically making reference to Aboriginal people in the Riverlands.
Yeah.
Now, the reference was more acute in terms of simply because the people that he was talking about were actually living out on an Aboriginal mission or reserve about 7 kilometres from the town. And because behavioural patterns of the two groups, when they came together, were quite different to each other. So therefore it created it perpetuated the language use around whenever any of those discussions came up. It perpetuated the same acute language use around that particular situation.
Like teens and tribalism.
Yeah, teens and tribalism and cheer squads and well, all those like cheer squads.
Mm.
But I said to them, my reply to him about what he was saying, and one comment he really made me was that, well, but you don't really have to worry about that because you're more like us. And I said, well, I've got news for you. I said, I'm not like them. And I said, I'm not like you. I said, but all I need for you to remember about me is who I am. And I said, my name is Bevan Wilson. I said, if you normally refer to me as Bevan Wilson, I said, you'll always get it right. I said, so Bevan Wilson is, there's no distinction there, even though the name might be a little bit French maybe, a little bit British, or a little bit, could be German or whatever. But I said, as long as you just get the name right, I said, you'll always be right. So the conversation ended really quickly, because I think the person had no answer to that, because it was a new sort of approach.
Yes.
I guess in a situation like that, it was a country town that was about 230 kilometres from Adelaide. And of course, a lot of people in those sorts of areas actually suffer from small town syndrome,
yes,
where they've never actually ventured outside of the borders of that particular area, either at all or very limited, so therefore their experiences were actually limited to that particular environment. So there we have that particular environment within itself was actually promoting racism and the language use around it.
Yes, and I guess a way to reply to that was last night when I watched this documentary on the children from the farm outside New South Wales. They had seen a documentary of people talking about terrible experiences, and people were coming out of the movie theatre where they had been showing the documentary, and many people were moved, but there was one man, very tall, who came out and said, no, I was one of the Fairburn children. He said, I had a wonderful time here. Of course, we knew that there were some people who essentially were sort of low life or scum amongst the children, but that was sort of their problem. And it was very illustrative of someone who had been quite badly affected by fitting into the system. He said, no, I had a wonderful time. He began, he said, I learned to kill, I learned to ride horses, I learned to butcher. He said, I'm a very successful butcher now. He said, of course, you know, there was rubbish women here and rubbish this and rubbish that. But and I thought, yes, well, I suppose you learned your lessons very well. And in a way, he denied that anything was unacceptable, and he had adapted and taken on the sort of norms and values of the rather oppressive system that they were under. He'd become perfectly adapted and was probably I would gather from the way that he was speaking about some of the children, particularly the females, that he was probably one of the perpetrators of the problem. It was just so evident in the language. But he would have been completely unable to see it from any other way. There was no cognitive dissonance whatsoever in the story. And very often I think people like to feel that they have all the answers. Things are very carefully put into categories, and they're not prepared to see any other point of view because it's just too confronting. It is uncomfortable and perhaps would make them realise their shortcomings, and I suspect that's on a much grander scale what setting terms of reference is about in terms of law and morals, and in fact even separating different domains of knowledge, saying, well, this is scientific, this is religious, this is one form of social science, this fits into another, why do you think so broadly? And
I want to know, is racism a male?
Sorry,
is racism a male? That's what I want to know.
No, I don't think so. I think that racism is also gendered, because many of the children actually spoke about, in this particular story, of terrible abuse by sadistic women who were house mothers. And these were all children from Britain, but they were seen as, you know, whinging pommy bastards by house mothers who were local. So it was othering, but it was also gendered. So
if you go back to the Crusades in Europe, because it seems to be like racism is like a dominant phenomenon. It's not something, I mean, it's still living. Now, this phenomenon has been around for so long and nobody's been able to kill it off. It's actually morphizing now into, like Norman was saying, in terms of the new racism and things like that. It's taken on a new shape, a new form, new subtleties. But if you go back to the question, and that's the reason why I asked you about was racism male.
Well, thinking about
going back to the Crusades, because of the dominance of the male, even back in the Crusades, and if you go back to the binary opposites, where that which is male and white is good, that which is male, female and black is bad. So I'm just wondering, is that still a phenomenon that's closely attached with racism, because two of them are fairly strong?
I think I would reply by saying that I think Durkheim said that in a community of saints, you will find sinners.
In a community of saints?
Saints. You will...
you will find sinners.
You will find sinners. The slightest infraction will be seen as sinful. Even, you know, it's a way of differentiating power. And I think that it all boils down to powerful groups trying to justify retaining power and using categories that may be around age or gender or race or culture or ability to walk in a straight line or to do any skill that may be valued in a particular context. So
I thought hegemony was strong. Oh, the word dominance, hegemony, male, strong, all those sorts of terminologies, basically, because of the way in which racism has developed, that it linked itself very closely, or these other words linked themselves very closely with that particular phenomenon.
I think that they linked, but in anthropology you will find that sometimes there were females who were dominant. Not often.
But given the general trend, that's why I asked the question whether racism was male, given the general trend throughout the development of humanity so far, you might have had some cases where women were dominant, but lots of other cases that it was probably attached a lot to male dominance.
Yes, I think that they are linked. But I don't think that it helps to I guess that's why I've never ever labelled myself as a feminist, because I see the bases for discrimination as being much wider than just gender.
It's a reaction to racism, again, because feminism is linked to things like, other words like inequality, social justice, all those sorts of things. Because why would they have brought about that particular terminology to describe this particular phenomenon where women are seem to be either too far to the left or completely on the right sort of thing.
Well, also gender studies don't encapsulate all the concerns, because in the issues that I may have as a female and the issues that another woman may have would be different depending on our experiences, our level of education, our cultural background. So there are lots and lots of our abilities, all those things are part and parcel. So I see them as systemically linked and important. I think gender is very important, and I think that the male dominant aspect has been important, and certainly the treatment of female women in colonial situations has been appalling, and it remains appalling in the war situations that are ongoing. So yes, it's certainly there, but I don't think it explains everything. Although the notion of male dominance, I think you're onto something, has certainly been the problem of trying to conquer the environment, and it sure as anything created a mess. And we're still trying to conquer the environment using the market to try and rescue us. And I think that kind of thinking is very problematic.
Because that thinking is problematic in terms of when you look at some of the world leaders. How many female world leaders are there?
Okay.
As opposed to male leaders. In most cases, men were seen to be aggressive. Not only aggressive physically, but in the way in which they think. So I'm thinking that in terms of that, just that alone, where you look at those countries, either within the Arab countries or within Russia or places like that, where their thinking is aggressive. In terms of how, you know, if we want to solve these particular problems. Something, I mean, America's also involved with this. Same with Britain. And to some extent, Australia. If we get thinkers at that particular level that are saying that this is the only way now that we can actually deal with this particular problem is go to war, kill each other, or take it by force. I mean, surely that thinking at that level, and even in terms of governance, when you've got thinking at that level, and even if you've got females thinking that at that particular level,
we have
got problems with racism as a phenomenon if we're going to defeat something like that. That's well and truly entrenched. If that is linked to that dominance and hegemony, and how do we solve problems in that sense? I'm just asking a question.
I think you're right. It gets back to this notion of binary opposition. We can actually profit at the expense of you, and it's the zero sum thinking that our nation state will do better if we are able to get away with something and do it at your expense, because our profit and your loss are quite separate, but they're not. They're actually linked, and that's the idea of the boomerang effect. What you throw out in pollution and poverty, you're going to get back in terms of destruction, climate change, conflict, war.
It was interesting. I went to a conference at UDSA, and it was around race and racism, and this was in 2007. And I thought, well, this ought to be good, because I want to see where I am with this, because I was looking at racism back in the 70s, 60s, 70s. And I thought, well, I want to see how far the thinking's come and what the discussion might look like.
Yeah.
Well, during the discussion, there were some thinkers from other countries there that around this race and racism. And one of the theories, or there was two theories, or two things that came up, rather. One theory was around racism stems from an emotion of anger. Now, he did explain how the theory works. But it was pretty raw in terms of while you can have lots of emotions, ego too. For one's ego, somebody wanted to develop their ego or want to up the ante on developing their ego, if they were better than them, if I'm better than them, therefore it's an egotistical thing that you say, because you're that colour and you're not as good as me, it makes me feel better, makes me feel stronger, bigger. So there was that sort of thinking that came out. It's very simplistic. And one of the other simplistic things that came out of it was that if you took the word race away, would you get rid of the word racism? I thought, well, that's even more simplistic, because of the fact that race has attached itself to every human, every society on earth. It's attached. Whether people like it or not, now it's going to be there. Every time you look at, I get up in the morning and I see somebody out in the street, it's going to be there. It'll remind me, because there'll always be the other.
But that's a construct that has resulted from the way in which we've been socialised. And I think the construct, and you began the argument by saying the construct isn't just race, the construct is binary oppositional thinking, and that I think seems to be embedded in the whole structuring of science, social and natural, and in our structure of government.
Well, can I ask you another question? Does that mean the words critical and analytical skills, those three words, are they also linked to racism then?
I think that they could be, which is
critical, why analytical.
If instead you say critical systemic and see the way in which things are linked, social, economic and environmental challenges are linked, they're convergent, and I believe you're absolutely right in saying that they're all linked to this binary oppositional logic, which needs to be replaced by a much more profound understanding through new physics, saying, which isn't new physics, I would argue it's indigenous wisdoms that many, many societies have had, based on the idea of inclusionality, overlaps. People like Darwin, I think, were not completely right. And what's exciting is that there's been a realization that it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival based on cooperation, not just us at the expense of them.
But didn't Darwin, that was only his observation though, given the experiment that he was doing.
Well, people have been looking at his work, people like Alan Rayner, and they say, well, yes, he had some very good ideas, but people have fastened onto fairly limited thinking. I mean, that was fairly old science.
Yeah. And was it good thinking at that particular time? That's what I'm getting.
Yes, it was.
Because it was advanced thinking at that particular
time.
See, we've had the benefit of them building that knowledge for us, so that we can say things in hindsight. Now, it's easy for us to do that because we can read about lots. But would I have come up with something like that back then? But analytical, the word analytical, I mean, obviously that one of the things about the binary opposites was that, and I think Norma Rob was talking about this in her research too, and I refer to her because I was just reading some of her work recently, that you have to some extent, scientists employ research methodologies to seek to get close to the truth, that which is really there in reality, or get close to reality. And they use scientific research methodologies, I gather, to look at, to get to that, to arrive at that particular point.
Mm.
In other social research, I think in some cases they use narrative stories or they use social research methodologies in extracting information from people, verbal information. So you're actually building your stuff on narratives to try and get to the truth. that which is real in that particular situation, whatever. But I'm wondering to see, like, analytical, like at that particular time, people like Darwin, I know he studied did a lot of work for quite a number of years.
Oh, it was brilliant. And to a certain extent, I think some of his work is being misinterpreted, because he wasn't talking about categories being completely separate. He was talking about the connections across species and the ability of species to actually transform. So he was talking about the connections.
And he was also talking about, like, the butterfly in Britain during the Industrial Revolution. The birds were able to pick up all the soot and dust that were coming down from the factories onto the trees, made them darker. So the lighter coloured butterflies were being picked up by the birds.
Yes.
The other butterflies that were darker in colour survived simply because they were better camouflaged.
Yes.
But then the use of the terminology to best reflect that particular environmental phenomenon.
Well, I think systemic is or holistic, non-dualist, understanding energy flows, connections. There's a whole new approach. I had a good day yesterday in that I thought that I was alone in banging on about new physics, but in fact there's a whole group of people now at the university who want to form a community of practice around this sort of approach. And this leads me to say it would be lovely if you would join, because we would like to put together an ALTC application for leadership in education around systemic, joined up thinking that values different kinds of knowledge and different ways of learning, simply because it's profoundly important for transforming the world, transforming the way in which we're doing things incorrectly, and the new physics isn't new, it's actually indigenous wisdom.
Yes.
And yes, it's informed by gender studies and feminism as well.
So we go to perpetuate the syndrome of racism. But anyway, so that's my thinking, some of my thinking around that.
I'm sure we can develop a vignette, because Norma was saying that she really liked the ideas that you were developing, and we can try.
Did she pick up that I may have been alluding to the fact that she was supporting racism by doing her PhD? No, I shouldn't go there.
No, you can. She is open to it. Yes, that is the point. And
I mean, we're trapped.
Yeah.
We're actually, because I wrote to her and I said that we're actually trapped in racism. Because here we are trying to reconfigure this thing. So we're actually trapped in thinking about this thing, this phenomenon.
But as a constructivist, she would have absolutely agreed with you, which is why she then wanted you to actually write this vignette.
Yeah.
So, no, I agree, because I see that we construct our reality, and that actually was the point that she was making.
Racism is good. That's the argument, you see, that racism is good. Because she's going to get her PhD out of this.
No, she's got her PhD.
Oh, she's going to get her other book out.
Yes.
And everybody's getting a healthier lifestyle to some degree. Some, not everybody, but I'm just saying there are those
who profit out of other people's misery.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is why I think that we should be looking at something like balancing individualism and collectivism and striving towards addressing social, economic and environmental needs, which is where I guess
what's the biggest phenomenon now that underpins racism?
You know, Bevan, to be...
Well, that's been identified. Well, that underpins racism at its very core.
I think it's about power, to be honest.
Power is one of them.
Yeah.
Power, because it comes with power and greed.
And scarcity and competing for scarce resources.
Yeah.
And people frame situations in order to justify having more so other people can have
it. When I just said that, and you were talking about that, I remember this came back up then, in the 60s, the 70s, that this sort of imbalance and all these sorts of things were occurring because of power and greed.
Yeah.
People's power, people's greed, and people's ego. Power and greed in particular.
Yeah.
And you look at the Crusades, again, the same phenomenon.
It was fighting for land and resources.
Yeah.
And that's actually at the basis of it, which is why I appreciate the issue of land.
But I was wondering to get out of the maze, because we're in the maze, you see. We're trapped in here. We're trapped in racism. I was trying to find the door out of the maze today while I was talking to you. And that's why I kept asking you some questions. And I thought you might, somewhere along the line you'll keep me going through the maze, and then I might find the door out where I can actually look in.
Spirituality is the door.
See it. Well, I'll keep my mind open, but I was trying to find that door so I can look in again. Because I'd rather look in from out there in the universe rather than look from inside out, because you get too many clouds.
I think that consciousness is the way out. Consciousness studies and realizing that consciousness is a continuum, and that we're all conscious, from plants to poor little laboratory rats.
How do we reconfigure the consciousness?
How do we reconfigure?
No, I'm just saying. We now need to find the way of reconfiguring the consciousness.
Thinking about our thinking is the way out, and talking.
See, that's knocked out of kids even in schools. A kid will ask you all these questions. I used to have a kid that used to drive me up the wall. A friend of mine and this kid, son, he had a son and two daughters. They used to help out in family a lot. This kid used to ask me all these questions, and it drove me up the wall. And I used to answer every question he had, but I never stopped him from thinking.
That's wonderful. Well, I guess Socrates also drove people up the wall, which is why they gave him hemlock to drink.
Poor old Socrates.
Yes.
He always asked the questions.
He did.
They were quite good questions.
They were excellent questions.
I like Socratic thinking.
So do I.
Because it keeps you open.
It does, and it's the basis for developing our capability to extend the boundaries and
but
to develop solidarity.
I'm sure our teachers there, even with the university training and the courses, they don't do. And that's one of the most biggest deflectors here in contemporary societies, because they're all about skills development in terms of getting out there providing a high quality service or making money. And that's not what society really needs. It really needs thinkers, consciousness.
Yes,
and
time,
thinking.
And people who are prepared to engage in conversations.
But we have to get Socratic thinking back in the university. This university is terrible, it's like lots of others I've come across.
I think that was fantastic. Thank you.